Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CPRMetro.org. Our guest today is Sarah Shord. Sarah is a writer, educator, and contributing editor at Solitary Watch, and she's currently based in Oakland, California. Her memoir, A Sliver of Light, Three Americans in Prison in Iran, is co-authored by the two people that she was captured and imprisoned with in Iran, Shane Bauer and Josh Fatal. It will be published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt in March 2014. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with Sarah Shord. Sarah Shord, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Hey, Cindy, and hey, everyone. It's great to be here.
Sarah, I'm so happy to finally be talking to you. I did do a lot of advocacy for you and Shane and Josh when you were imprisoned in Iran. I worked with your families quite a bit, so I'm just so happy to finally be talking to you.
Yeah, likewise, Cindy. I'm surprised we haven't run into each other over the years because, you know, we have a lot in common, and I've always admired your work.
It's almost a miracle we haven't run into each other. So, anyway, Sarah, please, my listeners are probably familiar with your story and what happened to you, but I want to go into a little bit more into depth. And what was your background before you were arrested and detained in Iran, which we'll get into soon also?
Sure. Well, I was living in the Middle East for over a year. I'd been living in Damascus, which at the time was a peaceful, wonderful place. I mean, especially wonderful for someone like me that was just really avid to and eager to learn about the Middle East. And I was studying Arabic at Damascus University, and I was teaching for a project called the Iraqi Student Project, which before moving to Damascus, I had been an ESL teacher, English as a second language, for several years. And I got a job with the Iraqi Student Project, which was helping Iraqi refugees in Syria get scholarships so they could continue their education either in Europe or the United States. Because as you probably know, most students that were enrolled in universities in Iraq after the occupation and war, the universities were either destroyed or shut down. And over a million Iraqi refugees were accepted and welcomed into Syria. And people opened their homes to Iraqi refugees and were really welcoming. But the one thing that the government, well, not the only thing, but there are quite a few things that they were banned from, and one was higher education. So I was teaching Iraqi refugees in Damascus and living there for over a year before we were captured and imprisoned. So it was basically one of the best years of my life, followed by the worst year of my life.
What do you think about what's happening in Syria right now?
Oh, it's horrifying. It's really horrifying, almost beyond imagination. I mean, everything that I hear is, it's really hard. I mean, you know, it's been going on for years now, so I've kind of hardened myself to it, mm-hmm. as have most of my friends. But I'm in close contact with a lot of my friends from when I lived in Syria. Shane, my now husband, and I, we lived in a Palestinian refugee camp called Yarmouk, and that camp has been kind of the subject of a game of tug of war between the Free Syrian Army and the Syrian government. Because they're Palestinians, both sides want to use them as for sort of propaganda value and make it look like the other side is abusing Palestinians or mistreating Palestinians. So the camp where we lived, which was diverse, exciting, vibrant community with fruit vendors and parties and all kinds of cultural events happening all the time, that camp has been under siege and has been occupied, and there are still tens of thousands of people trapped there with very little food getting in. The last I heard, they hadn't gotten food for weeks, and they were just subsisting on the little food they had left. So it's a complete nightmare. And really, I have such beautiful memories of that place. It's very hard for me to picture it in the state that it's in right now.
It's a very difficult situation, what's going on in Syria, but I don't know. The only thing I know is I don't want the U.S. to be involved in bombing more people, because that's what it seems like, almost like a rerun of what happened in Libya.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's important to look at each of these situations as unique. I also, of course, am very skeptical of any kind of UN intervention, in particular, any kind of military intervention.
Terrifies
me. But at the same time, we need to have international pressure to a degree that maybe we haven't even seen before against the Assad regime in order to get them out of power, because there won't be any peace in Syria until Assad and his regime have left. And in the meantime, so many people are dying. I'm hesitant to compare it to any other situation, but I do believe that the action so far from the international community has really been sorely deficient and inadequate. And I feel disappointed, really, in the international community.
Well, let's move. I don't know why. Are you hearing an echo when I talk?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I was getting some feedback. So let's move on to your situation and the your arrest and detention in Iran. And tell my listeners, you know, what it was like to go through that. I mean, we know the story, but you were an individual, a human being that was in that situation. What happened and what was going on from, like, from as a person that was there and that it was happening to?
You know, I still struggle for words after all these years.
Yeah.
Because it was the most defining experience. I can't really say it's one experience. It was a period of my life that truly showed me what suffering is. I mean, I suffered before. I haven't had an easy life. You know, I didn't grow up with a lot of privileges. My mom raised me herself, and we struggled. And, you know, bad things happen to people everywhere. But when you experience losing everything, and literally I was in solitary confinement for over a year. The entire time I was there, I was kept in solitary confinement, and it was 6 months before I was even allowed to call my mother and tell her that I was alive and hear her voice. Losing everything and having no idea when you're going to get it back is a terrifying experience, and I'm just really grateful that I was able to have enough resources, internal resources, and enough confidence in my family and my friends and the community at large that I knew I had faith that I would get out, and I really think that's what saved me from completely just losing my mind.
Were you surprised by the strength and resources you found within yourself?
I was, yeah. I mean, I think the first months of solitary confinement, I was kind of flailing, and I didn't have, I mean, you can't be prepared for a situation, you know, being held arbitrarily and incommunicado with detention.
Right.
I had no idea. I didn't know I had rights, but they were obviously stripped from me completely. I was never allowed to talk to a lawyer. It was just getting through the first few months was the hardest thing, because I had no idea where to start. You know, what every day felt endless. Every day was excruciating. The uncertainty, the anxiety. But you start to, at a certain point I realized if I didn't figure out how to do this, it was going to break me. You know,
right.
It was going to take away from me take something essential away from me. And once I found that determination that I wouldn't allow that to happen, and that it really, I found a strength in myself that was pretty unbelievable, and a discipline, and I just realized just how much I loved my life, that I was willing to fight for it.
It's unimaginable to most people what you went through. I mean, I've been in jail before. I've been in jail, I think the longest was 53 hours, but I was, you know, with other people in my cell. And it's just unimaginably horrific. But to just, like, extrapolate that to, I don't even know, infinity times more in your situation, and you must feel very sympathetic with people here in the United States and, you know, in California who are in solitary confinement and what they call the SHU. Have you done any activism around that?
Yeah, I have. And actually, Cindy, it's been such a really important part of my healing process and my recovery, is to be able to feel like I can connect my own struggle to the struggle of people in my own country in particular, and to feel like everything that I went through wasn't for nothing, because it actually helps me understand a reality that's very widespread, unfortunately. Solitary confinement is more prevalent in this country. There are more people in solitary than any other country, and in any other country in history, as a matter of fact. Up to 80,000 people on any given day are in solitary confinement, and many of them, I would go as far as to say the majority of them, for reasons that most people don't think would justify that kind of punishment. It's the most extreme punishment our prison system doles out. And people are in for arbitrary reasons. The guards and wardens of our prisons have a lot of power that is relatively unchecked. And the one thing that I feel grateful for is that there is a lot of awareness and efforts around the country to really shed a light on the lack of accountability in our prisons, and particularly on the use of solitary confinement.
Well, talk some more about your detention. You, I was reading that you actually did get out for two periods of a half hour each every day to be with Shane and Josh.
Yeah, that was my lifeline. And we had to fight really hard for that. We demanded that we were able to see each other. After 4 months, Shane and Josh were put into a cell together. And That's when I really started to lose my mind, because I realized that I was never going to get a cellmate, because there was no other American, and they said I couldn't be with an Iranian, which in and of itself is cruel and arbitrary. But when I realized that I could be in that situation for years, decades, I didn't think I could do it. You know, I thought, I can't do this. And that's when my really mental health was at its worst, and I started hallucinating. I had panic attacks, bouts of just screaming and literally beating at the walls of my cell. And luckily I was able to start seeing Shane and Josh, and that helped a lot with my mental health, because I had something to look forward to every single day, and I had people that loved me, you know, the people that I love the most. I don't think I could have gotten through it without those short periods. And Shane and Josh, were really there for me in a way that I can never describe, and never really repay them. Although it was a very empowering experience for me that I was released before them, and I was able to fight for their freedom. And it felt like all of the love that they gave me, I was able to funnel into that struggle to get their release, to procure their release.
Well, talk about your release for humanitarian reasons. That's what the information is that you got an early release because for humanitarian reasons.
Yeah, well, the real reason, I mean, the whole thing is a very cynical game. The Iranian government held us as political hostages as an attempt to get some kind of concessions from the U.S. government. Now, the Iranian government obviously wants to have an improved relationship with the U.S. government, and that's potentially happening now with the new president, Rouhani, and the nuclear negotiations are looking somewhat hopeful. But President Ahmadinejad was hoping to use us as a way to ease relations with the U.S. And when he saw that that wasn't going to happen, and international pressure had reached a climax against them, you know, many, many countries were involved. The country of Oman played a very crucial role in my release and also in Shane Josh's release. They decided to ease the pressure by releasing me first, and they released me right before the annual UN General Assembly that takes place in New York every year, where Ahmadinejad knew he would be called to task, and he knew he would be completely, you know, inundated with criticism, so he wanted to do something to kind of soften his image, and he released me just days before UNGA, and he did the same for Shane and Josh a year later. So it clearly has nothing to do with humanitarianism. It's clearly a cynical act of, you know, political calculation.
Talk about the international effort to obtain your release. And, you know, I want to say that when I became involved, I also want you to talk about this because, you know, I never believed it. But when I became involved, I was criticized because a lot of people were telling me that you all were CIA. So talk about the international response, and then talk about that accusation that you were actually spying on Iran.
Well, Cindy, it's interesting when I hear that from people, and it's good for me to hear because no one ever says anything like that to me to my face. But I think that, anyone who looks at the facts of our case, and, you know, there's so many stories in the media, the way something is framed from the beginning, the way it fits into people's preconceptions, people often jump to conclusions from the start. And unfortunately, I feel like, really, there's a lesson to be learned in the leftist community in the U.S. because I think we're apt to not believe our government because we criticize our government's policies rightfully. And sometimes the knee-jerk response is to believe the opposite side. Now, as many of my Iranian-American friends would tell you, they're just as critical of their own government. Iran's human rights abuses are absolutely horrendous. And the Iranian people are fighting a brave battle for freedom and human rights in their own country. And so I think it's kind of a knee-jerk response when people don't know much about our particular story to take a side. And I think it's a mistake to do that without really having enough information. Mm-hmm. The accusation that three Americans would walk into Iran that don't speak Farsi, didn't have any kind of... we didn't have passports, Iranian passports. I wasn't even covered. I wasn't dressed the way that it's mandatory for women to dress in Iran. There's no way we would be able to do espionage in that country. We would have been arrested within minutes. So the accusations are completely ridiculous if you look at them. But I think that, unfortunately, people jump to conclusions because somehow it fits into their worldview or they feel like it serves some kind of a... It teaches some sort of political truth that they believe in, which is that mm-hmm. we can't trust our government when our government says that people are innocent or not innocent, but people shouldn't trust either government. They should look at the facts.
Absolutely. And I it's interesting because I was criticized from the so-called left about this, but I was able to actually... like change some people's minds about it too. So, you know, to get more supportive. But talk about who supported you in the international community. You said Oman, and I think was it Switzerland that was very involved in?
Well, yeah, Switzerland plays, the Swiss government plays a role as the protectorate because there's no American embassy in Iran, so they handle any kind of American Affairs, our affairs pertaining to the U.S. government, and they were fantastic. They were able to get in to visit us several times, as was the Omani government. And the Omani government was actually really central in the negotiations starting a month or two after our captivity, and they were the ones that picked us up and brought us back to Oman to meet our families. So they played a very, very central role. And after I was released, I was able to appeal to both the governments of Venezuela and the government of Iraq, because we were actually in Iraq when we were called over the unmarked border into Iran. And so the Iraqi government felt responsible to some degree because we were behind a tourist site and on a trail, and the border there is unmarked, which is not a good situation. And the Iraqi government, especially in northern Iraq and Kurdistan, they really encouraged tourism, and they were actually, in 2012, I believe, on the New York Times top travel destinations, Iraqi Kurdistan was the 10th or 11th top travel destination in the world.
Be careful.
What happened to us was really unprecedented. Throughout the Iraqi war, no American, not even American soldier, was killed or kidnapped in northern Iraq for several decades. So what happened to us was unusual and unprecedented. But I did want to say that, the government of Venezuela, actually the late President Chavez, played a very crucial role and in Sheen and Josh's release, as did the Iraqi President Talabani. So really it was a conflation of several different efforts that made the pressure enough that it was really diminishing returns for the Iranian government. They realized that Sheen and Josh were no longer valuable to them, and the longer they kept them, the less valuable they would become, and they decided to let them go.
I think it was March of 2010, about your case, and put that, help advocate for you so he could advocate with the government of Iran. So I also was talking. It took Chavez a while to be convinced. Not that he didn't want to support you, but it was like a delicate, diplomatic situation.
Well, it took a lot of people, a while to be convinced. That's one of the, it's one of the problems, I think, with the international community, is it's kind of slow to act, but then once some people jump on, a lot of others will jump on. And, our case is a very small example of that, but look at Syria, look at what's happening in Palestine, what's been happening for decades in Palestine. Unfortunately, the international community is kind of slow to move, but it was really once Sean Penn got involved. Sean Penn and President Chavez were very, very close friends, so I think that was enough to really convince him.
So you have a book coming out next year. You and Shane and Josh have co-written a book, so we have a few minutes left. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. Our book is called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran, and it's going to be coming out March 18th. Our publisher is... What's that?
How exciting. Who's your publisher?
Oh, our publisher is Houghton Mifflin Harcourt.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be going on a book tour for a few weeks. And it's really exciting because Josh lives in New York now, so Shane and I don't get to see him as much as we'd like to. So we're going to have an opportunity to spend quite a bit of time together once the book comes out.
Well, awesome. I hope I get a chance to come to one of your events. So how can people find more information about your book and your story, Sarah?
Well, there's a lot of ways. If people want to follow, I have a newsletter connected to my website. My website is just by my name, sarahshord.com. And you can also friend any of us on Facebook. For now, probably my website, or you can follow my newsletter, or you can follow us, you know, through social media. We're very, very present on social media.
Well, I was so happy to receive your newsletter and connect with you so we can have the conversation. I had a newsletter from me.
Cindy, can you still hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
You were breaking up a little bit, but I can hear you now.
Oh, okay. I said that I'm really glad I got your last newsletter so I could connect with you. I don't know how I got on your list, but I'm really glad that I did.
Well, I've been wanting to connect with you for a long time. And, I admired your stance and your passion far before I even moved to the Middle East as a committed anti-war activist throughout my 20s. You were someone I looked up to, so I'm excited to be connected.
Well, Sarah, you certainly are a role model, and I really admire how you have taken your personal, tragedy and made it into a triumph, and also how you have extended it to activism to help other people. I was just in Santa Rosa yesterday protesting the murder of the 13-year-old Andy Lopez, and also there to support the family. And the family is so raw. They're so hurt, of course. They're in so much pain. But the only thing I could tell them really is to just keep fighting for justice and to help themselves to get justice for their son, but to also prevent it from happening to other Andes. And, you know, that's the only thing you can do is just be with people and, you know, try to support them through these things.
I agree, Cindy. And a lot of times people feel like what they do is not enough. And that was one of the things that I encountered a lot when I got out of prison, people saying, we've been working so hard, but we feel like nothing is enough. And I used to always say, look at me, I'm here. How can you say that what you've done is not enough? Like, this is a miracle. And for me, I'm completely convinced that what we're doing makes an impact, and that it's crucial that people believe that we can make a difference and see that we do.
But don't you think people get so trapped in this thing as that you have to, like save the entire planet when it can be just as, beautiful to help your neighbor? You know, people, I had Yoko Ono on my show once, and she said we can keep on trying to throw boulders into the ocean, or we can drop pebbles in the pond and see the ripple effect. And so I think sometimes thinking these kinds of ways might paralyze us from doing anything.
Yeah, definitely. For me, I feel like it's really important to make the connection with what's happening in our backyard to what's happening internationally, and to stay engaged and aware and pay attention, because this human drama that's unfolding around us, it's, it's got to be, you can't make anything up that's anywhere near as tragic and also beautiful, because the resistance that's happening on our planet is a beautiful, beautiful thing. And so making those connections between what's happening outside your front door and what's happening on the other side of the planet, I think is a really important practice. And also my own story has given me that ability to do that, because I, every day I write prisoners. Right now I'm I'm gathering stories of people in solitary confinement across the country, and I'm going to weave them together into a dynamic theater piece, a play called Opening the Box, and also hopefully a book, an anthology of writings of experts and survivors of solitary confinement. And every day that I hear, open up one of these letters and read what people are thinking, people that are stuck inside boxes and choosing life, despite the fact that they have no idea if they're going to get out, it really inspires me to rise to every day that I'm given. Because if people could do it in the worst situation, we could definitely do it on the outside when we have relative freedom and comfort and ease.
Well, that's a perfect way to finish this conversation. I hope we have another one maybe after your book tour, and you can catch us up on what you've been doing. So, Sarah, we've come a few minutes past the time you gave your website. Can you give that again?
Yeah, of course. It's just my name, Sarah with an H, Shourd, S-H-O-U-R-D, SarahShourd.com.
Okay, and I'll put it on my newsletter and in the show notes and things like that too. So Sarah, give my love to Shane and Josh, and it's been great to talk to you, and I hope we connect in person soon.
Yeah, I hope so too, Cindy. It's been great to talk.
Okay, I hope you feel better too.
Thank you.
You
too. Bye bye.
Well, that's the soapbox for today. I hope you learned something, and I hope you were inspired by Sarah's story. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer and the connection with CPR Metro, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank Sarah for being our guest this week, and as always, you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.